This weekend starts right after this.
Did you know that right now Geico is offering an extra 15% credit on car, motorcycle, and RV policies? That's 15% on top of what Geico could already save you. So what are you waiting for? Save an extra 15% when you switch by October 7th. Visit geico.com to learn more.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News, This Weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Harnessing Gen Z enthusiasm. I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for spending part of your weekend here. Coming up this hour, today's young adults appear to be leaning left, but why can't Democrats corral them? We'll have analysis. Also, why we struggle to admit that many of our financial decisions are tied to emotional feelings. Instead, we try to justify them. Plus, the home for sale in Missouri that comes with 9 very unusual features. And using apps, assistants, and smart appliances to remind kids about chores.
When a dishwasher is done doing the dishes, or the dryer is done with its cycle, it notifies the app, which then notifies the child that the dishes are ready to be unloaded from the dishwasher, or the laundry is ready to be folded and put away.
Julie Jargon at the Wall Street Journal on the new way to delegate your authority. For many children in the U.S., the usual back-to-school jitters are likely to be a lot more intense this year amid the coronavirus pandemic. Andrea Peterson, reporter at the Wall Street Journal, talked to psychologists about how to ease children's back-to-school anxiety. Andrea, what are you hearing?
Right. So, obviously, this school year is going to look very different for many kids, whether they're going back to school in person, part online, or totally online. And, you know, one thing that psychologists emphasized to me is that, you know, a lot of these kids have been out of school for going on about 6 months now. So, you know, back to school jitters are a normal part of fall for a lot of kids. But this one they expect is going to be, that anxiety is going to be a lot more intense.
You know, addressed to this whole idea of how some kids who were super anxious, perhaps, or very unhappy in school, were relieved to be sent home
right.
in the spring, but now they're kind of out of social practice, and
right.
they're not going to figure things out again.
So psychologists are particularly worried about those kids who already had a lot of anxiety about being in school, or those kids who had social difficulty, you know, navigating friendships, whether they had difficulty making friends or navigating the playground and the lunchroom. And so, yes, for some kids, when everything went remote, they were relieved to not have maybe the stress, the social stress, as well as, you know, some of the academic stress as well. So for these kids, it's particularly important to prepare for this new school year. And I got a lot of great advice on some of the things that parents can do to help kids manage their anxiety about going back to school, whether it's in person or remotely. People also said that, you know, some kids are also worried about, you know, the idea that, you know, even if they start school in person, that they're going to be, they're going to have to go online quickly, or that they're going to end up missing a lot of those special events and milestones as they did in the spring, whether it's, you know, a piano recital or a school dance.
Right.
So the first big bit of advice was that parents need to cope with their own anxiety, because I know a lot of parents, I'm a parent myself, have a lot of anxiety about their kids going back to school. And, you know, one psychologist mentioned to me that, especially for young kids, you know, if you can demonstrate a sense of calm and confidence, you know, that you believe, you know, she told me that the world is okay, that we're okay. Even if you are an anxious mess, if you can, you know, deal with that yourself, but then, present to your child that you are in control, that you're making good, that you are making good decisions for them, that they'll be much more calm and confident themselves. And another tip that the psychologist gave me was advising parents to listen closely to what their children's fears actually are. That one mistake she sees parents make is that they start talking about their own anxieties and sort of end up being ahead of children. And also, this psychologist, Dr. Khanna, actually, she told me that she has something that's called the 10-second rule. So after, pause before you start answering your child's question, give them 10 seconds, because oftentimes they'll give you more information if you don't jump in right away to either correct their information, as she says, or soothe them. Oh. And also, you may give them the opportunity to sort of problem solve themselves.
Right. We're speaking with Andrea Peterson, reporter at the Wall Street Journal. She's got a story entitled, How to Help Kids Manage Back-to-School Anxiety in the COVID Era. I thought one of the good suggestions, too, was to kind of practice some of these routines or experiences that kids might go through. How do you do that?
Right. That was a really important point, too, is that, take this opportunity before school starts. If you have another few weeks left, I know a lot of places have already gone back, but this school year is going to be very uncertain, and so prepare for as much as you can. If your child is going to have to wear a mask all day in school, make sure that the day they go into school is not the first time that they're trying to wear a mask for several hours. One psychologist actually suggested taking your child and a friend to a school-like setting. She suggested a library where you would wear your mask and, sit down socially distant from your friend and either read a book or use a computer and then wash your hands after. Just that exposing yourself to things you're anxious about actually eases the anxiety. The more you practice, the more you do it. And also, another thing is that you can take the opportunity. Another professor of psychology at University of Alabama, Susan White, suggested that to get your child together with a couple of other kids, in small groups, so that parents can help them practice wearing masks, being socially distant, while the parents are there to actually give them reminders and direction. If they see, especially good for kids who may be a little more impulsive, and it also can ease parents' anxiety too.
Thanks, Andrea. Andrea Peterson, reporter at the Wall Street Journal. 13 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. We all know that we should drink more water, but by the time you feel thirsty, it's too late. You're already dehydrated. That's why I've started using a product called Hydrant, a refreshing electrolyte powder that you mix directly into water to more efficiently hydrate your body. Each rapid hydration mix has the four essential electrolytes, sodium, potassium, magnesium, and zinc, and it's made with real fruit juice powder. The formula was developed by an Oxford scientist. The lime flavor is my personal favorite. I drink it during and after my workouts, whether I'm running or biking. It's $1 a packet for a 30-day supply. Save even more with a monthly subscription. Give it a try. Right now, we've got a special deal for our listeners. Save 25% on your first order by going to drinkhydrant.com/morning or enter our promo code MORNING at checkout. That's DRINKHYDRANT, drinkhydrant.com/morning, or enter promo code MORNING for 25% off your first order. And we thank them for sponsoring the podcast. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. This portion of the program is brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. The businesses of the future are being built today, and Michigan is where they start. Learn more by searching Michigan Pure Opportunity. According to a Pew Research Center study published in May, Gen Z is the country's most pro-government, anti-Trump generation, and 24 million of them are eligible to vote in November. But Gen Z has not always found the Democratic Party to be a reliable ally. Gabby Birnbaum, writer at The Hill, says while Gen Z voters are often progressive, youth activists and organizers are not yet sold on a party that many feel does not listen to them and is unsure of how to communicate with them. Gabby, explain.
I think essentially Gen Z voters feel for the most part taken for granted by the Democratic Party. I think among the youth activists, youth organizers, and researchers that I talk to, they feel like the Democratic Party sort of only reaches out to them right before an election, isn't really interested in what they have to say, and is just kind of counting on their votes without having earned them. And so a lot of them feel that they're less likely to then identify as a Democrat as a result, or even if they'll support Joe Biden now, less likely to form that kind of long-term party identification that Democrats should be gaining from Gen Z because they are so progressive in their positions.
Wow.
They should align with Democratic Party.
All right, so name the list of things kind of that they've been through and that they also feel they're not being heard on.
Yeah, absolutely. So Gen Z, I think, has grown up, it's defined as pretty much anybody younger than 24. And they've been through a really specific and unique economic and political context. They're in their now second major recession. It's 20 years pretty much of inaction on climate change, mass shootings. They've seen the cost of college rise, student loan debt balloon. And they've basically, Gen Z, you know, they've seen what millennials have gone through, essentially the same thing, and they're still dealing with injustice. They're still dealing with climate change. They're still dealing with student loan debt. And Gen Z is really just terrified that that's going to happen to them, and they want to work really hard to make sure the Democratic Party hears them and understands that they don't want to end up like millennials.
So how will they feel unheard? How do they plan to get heard, I guess?
Yeah, so Gen Z, something interesting I found out from talking to Jason Dorsey, who's a researcher with the Center for Generational Kinetics. Basically, Gen Z, because they're such digital natives, they're used to being heard in their daily interactions. You know, if they have a professor, they can go online, they can rate them. Mm. They can go post reviews for restaurants and brands. They're used to sort of being solicited by brands, engaging in active dialogue with them. So then when it comes to political parties, they don't feel that they're being heard in that same sense. You know, Gen Z overwhelmingly supports progressive policies. There's a lot of support for the Green New Deal, for Medicare for All, for canceling student loan debt, and they don't see the Democratic Party putting those into their policy platform, and they don't feel like the Democratic Party is engaging them, meeting them where they are online in these digital spaces. They're not doing it in what they feel is an authentic way, and so in order to be heard, they're taking to a lot of non-electoral routes. You know, they're protesting, they're in the streets, they're leading these online activism campaigns with hashtags, and they're sort of going about it in a non-electoral, non-official party way.
I'm just curious, based on what you said, if they feel that they're not being heard, why would they then think that government is the answer if they want government action on these items?
Yeah, it's a bit of an interesting dichotomy there. Something like nearly 80%, I don't have the statistic right in front of me, but it's, I think, something in the 70s% of Gen Z believes in an activist government. They believe that the government should be a force for good in people's lives and should be doing those things. And I think fundamentally they think the Democratic Party could do that because there are Democrats or independents like Bernie Sanders who caucus with the Democrats who they support. They supported Bernie Sanders overwhelmingly in the presidential primary. They like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez a lot. So there are Democrats that they like and that they feel can use government for that positive change. They want government action to help them with things like climate change, with things like student loan debt, but they're just not seeing it right now from Democrats.
We're speaking with Gabby Birnbaum, writer at The Hill. Her piece is called Democrats Struggle to Harness Enthusiasm of Gen Z Voters, generally folks who are under the age of 24. So is there a chance then that they sit things out come November 3rd, 2020?
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting question. Turnout for young voters is historically in any generation fairly low. You know, it's a fairly complicated process to vote, especially now with vote by mail, with absentee voting, with everything going on around that. It's going to be, you have to really convince young voters to vote. And so turnout in 2018, we saw, was pretty much a record high in decades for voters under 30. They voted at around 28% in a midterm election, which is still pretty low. But that's expected to be a lot higher for a presidential year. A lot of experts in that field are predicting record highs. I think a lot of Gen Zers feel that the stakes are just too high to sit it out. But, you know, thinking long term, if they don't see Joe Biden or Kamala Harris sort of moving to the left on the issues they care about, then turnout for future elections could be depressed. One thing that Gen Z really, really cares about is authenticity. So they really like a candidate who's unscripted, who sort of speaks off the cuff, who they feel is directly speaking to them and engaging them. And something I found is that you don't need to be a younger candidate like an AOC to attract their attention. Someone like Ed Markey, who's in his 70s, who's running for Senate re-election in Massachusetts, you know, maybe Ed Markey himself might not know internet slang or how to talk to Gen Z, but he clearly has hired people who do. His campaign sort of makes memes, engages with them on Twitter, partners with them to do things like phone banking. So I think I found if you have a candidate who's progressive and authentic and they actually hire young people, then Gen Zers are going to sort of run with that and they can almost run a proxy campaign for you online, being in those digital spaces that their peers are.
Thanks, Gabby. Gabby Birnbaum, writer at The Hill. 22 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend.
Michigan is one of the best places in the country to do business, but you don't have to take our word for it. Take Evan Lyles, CEO of Roush Enterprises, instead.
For the people that are involved in product development, there couldn't be more unique and exciting opportunities that are really going to shape the future of the world. It's a really exciting time to be in Michigan.
Big things are happening in business here. Find out why by searching Michigan Pure Opportunity.
When you talk to a Dell Technologies advisor, they're focused on you. They are real people ready to give real advice on everything from laptops to the cloud. And they offer tailored solutions powered by the Intel vPro platform to keep your small business ready for what's next. Dell advisors listen so you know that your small business needs have been met. Call a Dell Technologies advisor today at 877-ASK-DELL. That's 877-ASK-DELL. Thanks for joining us. When the coronavirus outbreak led schools to shut down in the spring, parents had to quickly rally, juggling their jobs with the added roles of teacher, tutor, and occasional IT technician. A stressful time, right? But one that seemed to have an end that coincided with the end of the school year. But with many school districts again shifting much or all learning online for the fall, those remote routines are resuming with no clear end in sight. Now employers and employees are grappling with how to adapt to a new reality. More from Charisse Jones, national business correspondent at USA Today. Charisse, what's up here?
Yeah, you know, people are really, really stressed out. I mean, I think in the spring we kind of looked at it as a temporary blip, right? This unprecedented interruption. People had to suddenly work from home. Kids were sent home from colleges, elementary, junior high schools. So you figure we can kind of slog through it, come up with some short-term fixes, and in the fall everything's going to be back to normal. And now a new school year is beginning. There's no vaccine in sight. Spikes are raging around the country, and so once again people are looking towards this new normal, and they have to figure out how are we going to accommodate it. And you just have so many mothers and fathers who are really freaked out. They're overwhelmed, and workplaces are having to navigate that and figure out how they help them meet these challenges but still meet the bottom line.
Man, all right, so explain the what the one woman is going through that you opened this story with, this Tracy Wells, right? She's got four kids. She works, her husband works. I mean, what do they do?
You know, it was just incredibly stressful for her. They have four children. The youngest one is now about 4 years old. But, you know, there's the emotional strain of you're at home and the kid sees you on the other side of the door and they want to hug or they want to play or they want their tears wiped and you're in the middle of a meeting. And then the husband has his meetings and then the kids all have their different Zoom classes at different times and there's homework. And so it got so bad that she literally took a leave of absence at one point. Because she just couldn't handle all of the anxiety, and now she's looking at this new school year that's upon us, and she's thinking we've got to do this all over again, and she thinks sometimes, you know, I just cannot manage this. And that's what a lot of mothers and fathers are feeling. I mean, they're so burnt out, there's so much going on in the world anyway, there's so much chaos, and then to have to manage all of these things is really proving overwhelming for a lot of people.
We're speaking with Charisse Jones, national business correspondent at USA Today, about her piece entitled Moms Brace for School Year Juggling Jobs and Remote Learning Amid COVID-19 Pandemic. So for the working moms then, since they do handle most of the stress here, how will their employers handle them?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a great question because, you know, certainly, again, employers have to make their money. They need productivity because they need to maintain their workforce. They have to make a profit. But they are trying to be a lot more flexible. I mean, one company that we spoke to, basically they're going to tape record meetings. And so whenever you have the chance, if you're putting your kid down for a nap at 1 and that's when the meeting occurs, you can listen to the meeting at 3 or 4 o'clock or maybe at 9 o'clock after dinner if that's when you have time. Job sharing is something that people are coming up with. You might have to take a little bit of a pay cut, but basically you split your role with another employee so you're on for maybe 2 days and then off for 3 days so that you can manage the workload a little bit better. IBM is going to do 4 more weeks of extended leave of absence where you're paid, and you can take that in different increments. You can take a few hours at a time, maybe 2 days off a week, maybe the full 4 week stretch, but again, it gives you that little bit of a cushion, that window of time, so you're not kind of losing your mind juggling all of these things. And then you really have to assess how are you going to manage expectations. Right? You know, everybody gets a performance review every year. Can you measure someone the same way when they have to take a break to, you know, help their kid get onto the laptop in the middle of the workday? And so those are all the kinds of things that people are weighing right now.
Mm. There's a risk of burnout, I presume, too.
Burnout is real. And you have to think about the employees who don't have kids. You've got about 35%, according to one survey, who already feel that their colleagues with children are kind of getting away with something.
Wow.
They're not pulling their weight. They're not doing the work. They feel that they're being burdened. And so that's the balancing act, right? That's the tension of trying to keep everybody happy while meeting these very unique challenges in this very unique moment. And we're still really kind of feeling our way through it. I mean, we really don't know how to do something like this long term.
Thanks, Charisse. Charisse Jones, national business correspondent at USA Today. 30 minutes after the hour now on This Weekend. Hey, glad you could be with us. I'm Gordon Deal. Coming up this half hour, battling COVID-19 in nursing homes with strike teams. Also, admitting that your investments are emotional. Plus, new apps, assistants, and smart appliances that can motivate kids to do chores, and the home for sale in Missouri with some very unusual features. We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. There's a new model being developed to battle COVID-19 inside residential care centers like nursing homes. It's called a strike team. Nurses and doctors from hours away come to aid sick residents and replace staff who had contracted the virus. They do things like set up oxygen and IV drips. It's a story by Hannah Critchfield, contributing reporter at the New York Times. Hannah, what are they exactly?
Strike teams are an idea and a concept that actually comes from the emergency management world. It's strike teams are often deployed in natural disasters like hurricanes or wildfires. But with the COVID-19 pandemic hitting the United States, they've now been deployed in nursing homes. And the way that it works is strike teams bring resources to a disaster scene, essentially. So in the case of an outbreak in a nursing home, they're bringing resources. They're these teams of about 10 people that will bring additional staff or testing or PPE to a facility to kind of help slow the spread of an outbreak early on and prevent it from further impacting vulnerable residents.
Got it. So who's typically on a team?
Yeah, so it's a variety of people from a variety of sectors, usually members of a local health department, the EMS director or another member from emergency management. And then it gets more interesting. It's this mix of sometimes nonprofits, businesses will volunteer PPE. In the case of a county-level strike team in North Carolina, which is where I'm based, they had this volunteer rescue squad of paramedics come in to do rapid testing. And so it's usually a multidisciplinary team.
And they stay for how long till they feel that the job is done? Or is there a specific time frame?
Essentially. So in natural disasters, strike teams usually stay about 72 hours. In my reporting, it looks like strike teams can stay for much longer in nursing homes. I mean, it sort of depends on what the need is for each facility. So I guess I'll talk about this facility Cherry Springs in Henderson County, North Carolina, which is a county that has a fairly large population of elderly people to begin with. And so the needs there were to provide a lot more medical staff. So they would send nurses from other nearby partner facilities, and the strike team would coordinate these nurses to come in, and they actually stayed for about about a month, I think, in this particular facility. So it sort of just depends on need, and it depends as the need changes. You know, EMS set up these decontamination tents to help staff remove PPE in the early days of the outbreak, but that didn't stay over the course of the 2 months that they had an outbreak. So it just really depends. Mm-hmm. And it definitely is something that is flexible based on need.
All right. We're speaking with Hannah Critchfield, contributing reporter for the New York Times. She's written a piece entitled A Novel Way to Combat COVID-19 in Nursing Homes, Strike Teams. So do nursing homes make a formal request to somebody for this?
Right. It appears that usually a nursing home will be aware that this strike team exists, either at the state level or the county level, and then they'll send out a request, usually to the local health department, who will coordinate the sending out of these teams. They're mostly voluntary. They're pretty popular in a variety of states, actually. Florida, Texas, Massachusetts, New Jersey, Ohio. It's something that seems to have proliferated all over the country.
And you said, too, in the story, that Congress may step in here and help fund them?
Yeah, so there is a bill that's currently been proposed by a member of the House of Representatives, Josh Gottheimer of New Jersey, and several others. It's a bipartisan bill. So you've got one Democrat or several Democrats and one Republican who helped write this bill. And it would actually allocate U.S. Department of Health and Human Services funding to specifically be allocated to forming these strike teams in states across the country. And so that was introduced in May and is currently just pending.
Thanks, Hannah. Hannah Critchfield, contributing reporter at the New York Times. 21 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Let me tell you about my new favorite way to pass the time while commuting. It's the app called Blinkist. Blinkist works on your phone, your tablet, or your web browser. Blinkist takes the need-to-know information from thousands of nonfiction books and whittles it down to just 15 minutes. Successful people like business leaders are well known for reading self-improvement books. I just finished listening to Snowball, a Warren Buffett biography. Listen to Blinkist while commuting or maybe exercising, even while you're waiting for your kids to finish practice. Blinkist has the latest titles from bestseller lists as well as the classic nonfiction titles you always meant to read. I also like listening to some of the history titles since I never had much good history in school. Right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/morning to try it free for 7 days and save 25% off your new subscription. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/morning to start your free 7-day trial. You'll also save 25%, but only when you sign up at Blinkist.com/morning. Glad you could spend part of your weekend with us. When a family opts to purchase a Mercedes, say, rather than a Subaru, the rest of us might think they're being extravagant, but we wouldn't say it out loud. So why aren't we that forgiving when it comes to investment and personal finance decisions? We should concede there's an emotional element to many of our own financial decisions, and we should stop pretending otherwise. More from Jonathan Clements, founder and editor of HumbleDollar.com. Jonathan, how do you see it?
So most of, and maybe even all of the financial choices we make have an emotional component. And you know, we readily concede when we make other financial decisions, we choose to buy a house, or we buy a car, or you know, we buy an item of clothing. We never try to say this is a totally rational choice. But when it comes to hardcore personal finance and investing decisions, somehow we're meant to be completely rational. And it simply isn't the case. Every financial decision we make has some sort of emotional component.
So why is it sometimes that we feel the need to justify it?
I guess it's because, that's a great question. I guess it's because in the realm of money, you know, we are only talking about dollars and cents, so it seems like we should be going for maximum dollars and cents. But the fact is, you know, when we put together a portfolio, for instance, you know, we're trying to build a portfolio not simply to make the maximum amount of money, but also build a portfolio that we can sleep with at night. We want to have a mix of stocks and bonds that we're comfortable with. And yet people come along and say, well, you know, why do you have so much in bonds? People are reluctant to say, well, actually, it's because I'm an investment wimp, but I really don't want my portfolio to go down so much. And so they come up with these convoluted explanations for why they built the portfolio that they have. And what I would say is it's okay to admit that there is an emotional element to your financial decisions. You just can't let that emotional component go too far. So, for instance, a lot of people like to trade individual stocks, and all of them will pretend that they're earning market-beating returns, but really, when they're trading stocks, they're just doing it for fun. They get a thrill out of it. Mm. So that's fine. It's fine to get a thrill out of it. You just shouldn't be getting a thrill with your entire portfolio.
Right.
So what you want to do is carve out 3 or 5% of your portfolio and say, okay, this is my fun money account. I'm going to trade individual stocks. I'm probably not going to get great returns with this money, but I am going to get a lot of fun. There is an emotional component to it, and that is fine, as long as I limit the amount of damage that I do to my overall finances.
We're speaking with Jonathan Clements. He's the founder and editor of HumbleDollar.com. He's written a piece about the emotional component of financial decisions. You said, so a lot of people like to invest in companies that meet these various environmental, social, and governance criteria, the ESG. Nothing wrong with that.
you're right, Gordon. A lot of people invest in these so-called ESG companies, these companies that meet these environmental, social, and governance criteria, and they do it because these companies line up with their values. They think it's important to invest in companies that are nice to the environment, that don't sell cigarettes, that don't sell alcohol, whatever it is. But they then take this additional step, which is try to justify their fondness for these ESG companies by saying that they're going to get better returns. And the evidence on this one is mixed. And what I would say is stop with the justifications. If you're investing in these companies because they match your values, admit as much and let's move on. Let's stop fooling around, pretending that there's a, you know, something here that isn't. And I would just take this one step further, which is it's not simply that we should admit there's an emotional component to many of our own decisions. Now, I would also encourage people not to criticize the financial decisions of others when they do it for emotional reasons. One of the things I see on social media, Gordon, all the time is somebody will mention that they have a particular mix of stocks or bonds, and then other people will weigh in and say, that's, you know, you're being way too aggressive or way too conservative for your age. You know, you should be doing this. There isn't an objectively right mix of stocks and bonds for everybody. It comes down to our risk tolerance, and if our risk tolerance is really high or really low, it's going to drive what mix of stocks and bonds we have, and we shouldn't be criticizing people for investing according to their risk tolerance.
Thanks, Jonathan. Jonathan Clements, founder and editor of HumbleDollar.com. 13 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. The T-shirt is a menswear staple. Unfortunately, the basic tee we love has its issues, right? Shrinkage, bacon neck, fading, and stretching, to name a few. But the modern take on the classic T-shirt from Cuts Clothing has completely changed the game. With their amazingly soft, custom-engineered Pika Pro fabric, Cuts T-shirts have an athletic, tailored-looking fit that's comfortable anywhere from a day in the office to a night on the town and everything in between. I have to say, I love my Cuts T-shirts. I've worn them casually with shorts and sandals, but also under my suit jacket in more professional settings. They're one of the most comfortable, durable, and fashionably flexible shirts I've ever owned. Plus, they're pre-shrunk, wrinkle-free, and hold their shape over time, no matter what style you prefer. That's why Cuts is the only shirt worth wearing. Get 15% off your first order by going to cutsclothing.com/Gordon. That's cutsclothing.com/Gordon for 15% off the only shirt worth wearing. Again, cutsclothing.com/Gordon. Thanks for spending time with us. Instead of telling your kids to unload the dishwasher for the millionth time, why not program virtual assistants to do it for you without any twinge of exasperation? And if you have high-end smart appliances, they can notify the kids, say, when the dishes are clean. It's a story by Julie Jargon, columnist at the Wall Street Journal. Julie, what did you find?
What I found is that parents are getting really tired of having to nag their kids to do their chores. We've all been at home for a long time together, and this is only going to continue to drag on for quite some time, especially with a lot of schools being remote now. So those dishes really tend to pile up in the sink. And so what parents are doing is trying to offload that mental burden that they have of having to remind their kids to do chores by turning to virtual assistants that they can program to provide reminders to their kids to unload the dishes, make their beds, what have you. We're turning to apps that can do the same thing.
We're speaking with Julie Jargon. She writes the family and tech column for the Wall Street Journal. This piece is called Kids' Chores Starting to Bore. New apps, assistants, and smart appliances can motivate them. All right, so how do they work? Give an example.
So one example is an app called S'mores Up. It's a family management app that recently entered into a partnership with BSH Home Appliances, which makes Thermador and Bosch appliances, and they're integrating their smart appliances with the app so that when a dishwasher is done doing the dishes or the dryer is done with its cycle, it notifies the app, which then notifies the child that the dishes are ready to be unloaded from the dishwasher or the laundry is ready to be folded and put away. So that's one thing. Kind of this whole new smart home area where appliances are talking to apps and apps are talking to people. Yes, the home of the future. And then also there are, you don't have to have fancy appliances to do this. People who have Alexa-enabled devices or Google Home devices can set reminders. They can say, Alexa, you know, tell the set a reminder to take out the trash, and they can have that reminder verbally tell their child at a certain pre-programmed time, you know, it's time to take out the trash. And they can have that go through their Echo Dots or through smartphones to remind the kids when it's time to do certain chores.
Anybody say that this you know, takes away perhaps valuable face-to-face communication with kids?
There is that argument that, you know, technology is a crutch, that, you know, will kids ever develop the self-reliant skills to do these things on their own? Some parents that have responded in the comments section have said, you know, it's just another way to outsource parenting. As a parent, you should, your kids should just listen to you when you tell them that it's that they need to do something. Shouldn't have to rely on technology to do it. But, you know, parents are busy, especially now. I mean, it's just an extra busy time. There's a lot of things going on. It's easy to forget some of the things you have to do as a parent. And it's easy to forget even that, you know, those dishes need to be done. So. Yeah. Yeah, it's just another tool parents are able to use if they want to.
Thanks, Julie. Julie Jargon, columnist at The Wall Street Journal. Her column is called Family and Tech. 6 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. When you talk to a Dell Technologies advisor, they're focused on you. They are real people ready to give real advice on everything from laptops to the cloud. And they offer tailored solutions powered by the Intel vPro platform to keep your small business ready for what's next. Dell advisors listen so you know that your small business needs have been met. Call a Dell Technologies advisor today at 877-ASK-DELL. That's 877-ASK-DELL.
Michigan is one of the best places in the country to do business. But you don't have to take our word for it. Take Patty Poppes, president and CEO of Consumers Energy, instead.
All of the innovation that's occurring around robotics, AI, it's happening here in Michigan. We have chemical companies, we have pharmaceutical companies, we have medical device manufacturers. Michigan is a magnet for innovators and dreamers.
Big things are happening in business here. Find out why by searching Michigan Pure Opportunity.
Well, finally, a home listing in Missouri is offering way more amenities than hardwood floors or an updated kitchen. It also has what appears to be a functioning jail. USA Today says the two-bedroom, two-bath home for sale at $350,000 was originally the Howard County, Missouri Sheriff's House and Jail in 1875. The home has been rewired, features updated. There's plumbing, a new HVAC system. The listing says the property underwent an extensive renovation, but the highlight is clearly the jail, which includes 9 cells, a booking room, and a half bath. And a bonus, the cell doors lock and appear to be in working order. According to the Howard County Sheriff's Office website, it was typical for a sheriff and their family to live in a residence where the jail was located. The first jail opened for occupancy in 1894. The jail is among several buildings in Fayette, Missouri, that are part of the National Register of Historic Places. The residence was sold on eBay, and the buyer had it restored. That'll do it for this hour. Thanks for listening to This Weekend. I'm Gordon Deal. Did you know that right now, GEICO is offering an extra 15% credit on car, motorcycle, and RV policies? That's 15% on top of what GEICO could already save you. So what are you waiting for? Save an extra 15% when you switch by October 7th. Visit GEICO.com to learn more.